You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court gets a lot of the limelight, but our guest says we should pay more attention to the lower federal courts, too. We'll take a look at President Trump's nominees so far with almost 150 vacant federal court seats. Now, on Tuesday, UW Superior announced that it will suspend 25 academic programs. That includes 9 majors, 15 minors, and 1 graduate program. Since 2014, the school has now suspended 40 of their programs. Robert Mentzer is the statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday for a look at some of the week's biggest state news. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, why did UW Superior suspend these 25 programs?
Well, this is, a short answer is the university has a $2.5 million deficit. They have had a similar budget shortfall in the past several years, and of course, the UW system as a whole has seen declining state funding for years as a part of what is driving budget troubles. It's also the case that many smaller UW campuses, the trend line overall is to fewer students, declining enrollments, though probably, it's notable that is not the case in Superior this year. They were up 3% this year. They're looking at, declining resources, and these program cuts are part of that story.
Now, 40 programs after these new cuts, how have faculty and students responded to these program suspensions?
Well, people are really sad. And, part of it is the way that the university announced these cuts on Tuesday. Certainly it came as a shock to the university community, according to the reporting that's been done. The faculty was not involved in or warned of the decisions, and in the statement that the university put out, they made a very shallow argument that this is actually for the good of students, because students can get overwhelmed if there are too many courses offered to them. It's sort of thing that there's a germ of truth in that, and that there is actual research about that exact phenomenon. But I think it just comes off as very self-serving when, on its face, what the university is doing is, making a financial decision.
Some of the majors suspended include things like journalism, political science, sociology, pretty standard university offerings. Is there a concern that this could affect enrollment at UW-Superior if people are hoping to have those options?
Right, so they're in the situation now where students who are enrolled in the programs can finish out their majors. They won't be taking new students into the majors, but the class offerings don't just like immediately cease. The university also says that this is, cutting professors is not a part of this. Staff cuts are not a part of this, and administrators argue that they'll still offer some classes in sociology or theater or journalism, just not as part of a major track. They may be part of a more general education offerings or whatever.
Is there concern beyond Superior that this could be a sign of things to come for smaller UW campuses?
No, absolutely no doubt about it. And this is an emotional subject, and people feel very passionately about it. I don't mean to reduce it to an intellectual exercise, but a question that the UW system as a whole is confronting is, does every campus need to offer every subject? Now, you could imagine a system where, the UW-Stevens Point has the state's greatest paper science program, Superior has the best communications program or whatever it may be, and basically students go where their interests lie, or if they can't move, they use distance learning technologies. Again, you could imagine that system. The way that this is happening is much more sort of at the barrel of a gun. It's administrators trying to make their budgets work, and I don't think that people within the UW system feel confident that there is a sort of a global vision to that. This is the problem that we are solving, is for especially in smaller campuses, especially in more rural areas, what is the university campus obligated to offer locally?
Talking to Rob Metzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the big news around Wisconsin. Rob, a new report from the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights group ranked cities across the country on their friendliness toward the LGBTQ community. What did it say about cities here in Wisconsin?
Well, a mixed picture, as you might expect. So this is the an annual ranking done by the Human Rights Campaign, and they looked at they scored 7 Wisconsin cities on a from 1 to 100. Overall, Wisconsin's average was 59 out of 100, which is slightly above the national average that this group found. National average is 57. The best scoring Wisconsin city is probably the one that everyone would expect. The most progressive city in Wisconsin, Madison, scored 100 out of 100. Milwaukee scored high at 92. Appleton had a 78. And down at the bottom, Oshkosh and Racine scored just 29 on a 100-point scale.
And what were some of the main things that the cities at the lower end were lacking, according to the authors of the report?
Well, so this is an interesting report, and it's worth sort of digging into for people who are interested in the subject, because they're taking a bunch of complex factors and reducing them to a number. So if, you know, there is a level of simplification, but they are looking at objective measures. So it's does the city have a rule that explicitly forbids housing discrimination based on gender identity or sexual orientation? Does the city's police department have an officer who is designated as a liaison on LGBTQ issues? A number of other measures, but they are objective measures, and you can, so, you know, if you're an activist in one of the cities that scored more poorly, you know, Green Bay scored a 40 or Kenosha scored a 43, you can look at those measures, and there are, like, specific and objective policies you could advocate for, or positions that you could advocate for. So it's an interesting way of sort of measuring something that can be a little bit more abstract, like LGBTQ friendliness.
And Rob, I want to wrap up with a story from Wisconsin's music scene. Come on, skinny love, just let's sing it. It is the 10-year anniversary of Bon Iver's first album, For Emma, Forever Ago. This is Skinny Love, the most widely played track on that album. And it sounds like Eau Claire native Justin Vernon, frontman of the band, just announced a show in Milwaukee. What do we know?
Yeah, this is one of those special shows where it's the 10-year anniversary of this album, and he's going to have a show in Milwaukee that performs that album front to back with as many of the people that he worked with 10 years ago as he can get. And a lot of people in Wisconsin love this guy, Justin Vernon, and so it could be a pretty fun show.
And Bon Iver really put Wisconsin and Eau Claire on the map when it comes to the national music scene.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the guy won a Grammy for Best New Artist. He's like friends with Kanye West. He's everywhere now. And this debut record it has a fun origin story. Vernon had been having sort of a bad time in his life. He was depressed. He had some physical illnesses. And he went up to his family's hunting cabin out in the Wisconsin woods and wrote and recorded the majority of this record, For Emma, Forever Ago, which is the anecdote that is told in every single profile ever written of Justin Vernon, but still is it's a pretty good anecdote. I'm not immune to its charms.
Briefly, Rob, are you going to go to the show?
Listen, it's a bit of a drive. I mean, I like Bon Iver as much as the next guy. I do think the guy has a beautiful voice. He's a I like the. Some people are annoyed by the falsetto, but I think he has a lovely voice. I would see it. I'll watch the. Someone will live stream it.
Well, you have a lovely voice too, Rob. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Robert Metzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. Coming up, there are a lot of federal court positions waiting to be filled in the United States. We'll take a look at the president's nominees and why they matter. Stay with us on Central Time. First, there are lots of federal court nominations making their way through the U.S. Senate, but they don't get the high-profile attention that a Supreme Court nomination gets. Our next guest says we should pay more attention because a lot of the biggest decisions in the U.S. court system never make it to the Supreme Court level. Kimmy King is a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, we focus a lot on the Supreme Court, Kimmy. Can you talk about the importance of these federal courts below the Supreme Court level?
Well, actually, that's where all of the action is. Remember that the district courts set the record. They are the triers of fact. And what they determine, their initial decision, usually winds up being predictive of how the process is going to go through the appellate stage. Once you move up to the Circuit Court of Appeals level, the level just beyond the federal district trial courts, virtually 99% of all decisions that come out of the Circuit Court of Appeals are going to be the final decision. In many ways, the Supreme Court is really a rarity for the typical litigant in the federal courts. Remember that the Supreme Court receives petitions for 8,000 cases in any given year, and typically they only hear between 80 and 100 and then ultimately decide on those. So it is very easy to argue that the lower courts fly under the radar and that a president will want to stay focused on those lower courts because that's where the real decision is made.
And President Trump has something in the neighborhood of 150 vacancies in these courts to fill. There are nominations out there for about 50 of them. What do you think, first of all, of the pace of the nominations and the Senate action on them?
So the Senate action has been moving forward on it, and he certainly had a number of vacancies to fill as a result of the Obama administration. In the last months, we typically consider a president to be a lame duck where he can get nothing done. And most people will recall from the Gorsuch nomination to the Supreme Court, you know, the Senate had specifically said that they left that seat that had been vacated by the untimely death of Justice Antonin Scalia. They left that seat vacant knowing that they were going to be able to put in Gorsuch. So that filtered down then into the lower courts.
And what do you make of what we know about the president's nominees as far as their judicial preferences, ideology, that kind of thing?
So one of the things that you see when you look over the persons who have made it on so far is that there clearly is a bent toward the conservative. And one common characteristic that they have is that they have been a member or have been affiliated with or have lectured, given public speeches to the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society is one of the preeminent legal organizations in the country that works with conservative think tanks, conservative lawyers, conservative interest groups on trying to bring litigation in the federal courts to challenge what they see as policies that are outside of the original constitutional intent. And so that pretty much breaks down along the boundary lines of conservative versus liberal.
When the Senate is considering a nominee, how important is ideology and background? How much can they consider that?
So it's a bunch of different things that they take into consideration, and it's actually quite a long process that a judicial nominee can go through. You have seen some nominations that can take up to 2 or 3 years if there's a real challenge in a candidate's record, if you look back historically over time. And you have to go through an extensive FBI background check. They get input from different organizations for the folks on the list. Then the ABA, the American Bar Association, will weigh in and interview people. And then you get to the Senate confirmation hearings. And that's where you really start to look at things like judicial background, ideology, judicial temperament. And what we've seen with the Trump administration, and you see that in any, honestly, you see that down through time, really since the 1960s, judicial nominations have become very volatile. It's there that the minority party, and it doesn't matter whether you're a Republican in the Obama era or a Democrat in the Trump era, that's where your chance to kind of stick it to the president comes in. Keep in mind that, you know, when we look at President Trump, the fact of the matter is he's been fairly fortunate in getting his Circuit Court of Appeals judges through for appointments. He's already had 8 nominees confirmed in 10 months. Understand that in the last 2 years of the Obama administration, there were only 2 appeals court judges confirmed. So that's why most people focus in and say that the Circuit Court of Appeals are moving much more quickly.
We're talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, looking at judicial nominations in the Trump administration. It's not just about the Supreme Court. And Kimmy, let's talk about the process and the power of the minority party, in this case the Democrats, to delay or even thwart a judicial nomination. What kind of ability do Democrats have if they really don't like a particular nominee?
So understand that part of this process and why we're where we are now is as a result of a struggle that the Democrats in the Senate feel like they faced under President Obama. And they felt like Republicans were, you know, causing all kinds of grief with getting his candidates through. And so there are procedures in the Senate that you can use. So you have the Senate confirmation hearings, and those have been a little testy, particularly this week. Those who have been following it know that this week there have been some sharp interchanges with some of the candidates that Trump has put forward. And so you've seen some of that stickiness play itself out. But then on the procedural rules, there, under Senate rules, without taking you into a long, complicated process, underneath the Senate rules, even though a candidate only needs a majority, 51 of the 100 senators, there is this thing called the vote of cloture, which to close off debate in the Senate, you have to have 60. Well, when you have a 52-48 Senate, it's very close, and you can see the minority party threaten this filibuster. So what happened is that in November 2013, the Democrats changed the Senate rules to allow a simple majority rather than the 3/5 supermajority to close off debate. And it was the change of that Senate rule that caused much of the consternation about the Senate becoming overtly political.
That would have allowed Democrats to get more of President Obama's nominees confirmed, I imagine. Are they kicking themselves now, though, that the rule that they changed is being used by the other party?
Yes, they are. And you see some of that for those who are watching this week. Again, Leonard Grass, who is up for nomination at the Eighth Circuit, actually got really grilled by people pointing out that he had received a not qualified rating from the ABA, and then the Grass responded that, well, there was one abstention, and then the Democratic senator pointed out that was because, you know, a senator had been out sick. That's why there had been the abstention. And then he reminded Grass that the last nominee who had a not qualified rating had had to withdraw their nomination. So what's happening is the Democrats are kicking themselves, but they're also sticking it back in and reminding the candidates, the judicial candidates, what the process is supposed to be all about.
You mentioned the American Bar Association. They've declared 2 nominees unqualified, one that you mentioned in a circuit court level, one in a district court. How common is it for the ABA to give an unqualified ranking to a judicial nominee?
It is not very common at all. In fact, Grass is the first nominee since 2006 to receive a unanimous not qualified rating from the ABA. Now, of course, President Trump's administration fired back that the ABA tends to be liberal. There's some grounds for argument there. But as a general rule, there has been a tendency to look at what the ABA says and take that into consideration.
As I understand it, the ABA has rated 42 of President Trump's nominees. 40 of them were not qualified. They were qualified or better.
That's correct. They received as qualified or even well qualified, in fact. And it typically is the case that you see most candidates getting a well qualified, and if not that, even a qualified. it's this category of not qualified that becomes problematic. And so in the case of Grass, you know, they pulled out all kinds of information about things that he had said and done. There is another candidate that is up. His name is Bush. No relation that I see to any of the real the other Bushes. But they really were looking at his nomination quite harshly because he has been a conservative blogger. And I think that that's also emblematic of the Trump administration trying to put into office candidates that don't usually fit the typical mold. I mean, your typical judicial nominee for a district court or a federal court of appeals is someone who has had previous judicial experience or extensive litigation experience. And he has definitely opted for a non-traditional route. You see, for example, he nominated this, and she just was successful this week, Notre Dame Law School professor Amy Barrett, who had clerked for Justice Scalia. And they really got into ugly questions during her confirmation hearings about her Catholicism. And Republicans challenged that this was, in essence, a religious test of the candidate and, you know, challenged the Democrats for being religiously biased because she was a Catholic. And she has spoken about practicing her faith in a professional context in related public statements. So they really did go after Barrett.
We'll leave it there for now. Kimmy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. You take care. I love public radio.
That's Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Now, Politico published an explosive excerpt from former Democratic National Committee interim chair Donna Brazile's upcoming book, looking back at the 2016 presidential election. In that piece, Brazile alleges that financial mismanagement of the DNC created an opening for Hillary Clinton's campaign to exercise a lot of power in the party during the primaries. And she says the relationship between the campaign and the DNC helped Clinton at the expense of then-candidate Senator Bernie Sanders. Susan Johnson is with us now. She's an associate professor of political science and the director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Good to be with you.
Well, this piece got a lot of reaction. Susan, what was your immediate reaction on this news when it came out?
Well, I thought it was really interesting, given the fact that I had thought that Donna Brazile had been a supporter of Hillary Clinton, and obviously she was as a fellow Democrat. But the last thing I recall about Donna Brazile was the fact that she had provided Hillary Clinton with some debate questions. And if people recall that during the Democratic nomination period, when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were holding debates, it came out afterwards that she, as a member of the, when she was on CNN, she knew what some of those questions were going to be, and she fed them to Clinton. So I find this kind of curious after knowing that.
Right. Let's talk about some of the motivations here before we get into some of the specifics. Some people, Bernie Sanders supporters in particular, saying, yeah, this proves what we've been saying all along. Some people have been pointing toward, you know, when you have a losing political campaign, one good thing for a political consultant to do is distance themselves as much as possible from that campaign.
Well, you know, to a certain degree, I agree with that. But on the other hand, if she hopes to take a leadership role, you know, in Democratic politics moving forward as a consultant, I don't know that writing the book is fine, obviously, but talking about some of the stuff that she's talking about is going to necessarily endear her to certain segments of the Democratic Party, and maybe that was her intention. I mean, maybe she's clearly now trying to align herself with a different segment of the Democratic Party.
Let's get into what she was talking about here. It seems to center around fundraising and revenue sharing between the Clinton campaign and the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. They were having money trouble. They signed deals with Clinton, who used this deal, and with the Sanders campaign, which did not really, which involved, you know, Hillary Clinton going to states, raising money, in theory, sharing some of that money with state parties. But what happened, according to Donna Brazile?
Well, according to Donna Brazile, not a whole lot of money made it back to the states. And when this arrangement was agreed upon between the Clinton campaign and the DNC, it was at a point where the DNC was, as you had mentioned, doing quite poorly in terms of money and had been in debt, in fact. And she also, Donna Brazile, also had some negative things to say about how Barack Obama left the party as well in terms of fundraising and things like that. And so it sounds like the Clinton campaign came in and indicated that they would be, you know, taking over the fundraising apparatus, and as a result of their taking over that fundraising apparatus and theoretically funding party operations, that would also be helping state candidates and congressional candidates, that they would get to make decisions about messaging, about who was sort of running the operation. So it was, as the article indicated, according to Brazile, a takeover of the DNC by the nominee, and I'm sorry, by someone who was trying to get the nomination. And that's the key point here. It's quite common for once someone gets the nomination to then assume authority over the national party. The key issue here is that this agreement was signed in 2015, and from what Donna Brazile says, the Clinton campaign was running the DNC before she was actually ever the official nominee.
And does this give add fuel to the flames of Bernie Sanders supporters who say, excuse me, that the DNC was not fair to their candidate?
Well, I think that this allows Bernie Sanders supporters to say, see, we told you so. I think that Bernie Sanders was running as an outsider candidate. We knew that. He's not a Democrat, in fact, so I think that might be a response from people who are more likely to support Hillary Clinton. And then also there could be the argument that, as you mentioned, he also had the opportunity to enter into a fundraising arrangement in the same way that Clinton did, and he chose not to. So I think that opened the door a bit for the Clinton campaign to go in and begin that takeover.
But Sanders had pointed out even during the campaign what he saw as the misuse of this money not going to the state parties the way it was supposed to in the deal, the imbalance in the way he saw the DNC treating the two campaigns. I mean, there is something there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you look at some of the numbers that have come out that Donna Brazile put out there, that very little of that money went back to the state parties. I mean, very little. And that speaks to some of the criticism that we heard during the campaign of different states arguing that, in fact, they felt like they weren't getting support from the Democratic Party. And so I think there's definitely a complaint, to be made on behalf of the state parties as well, that there were negative consequences as a result of everything being directed toward Clinton's campaign.
And this is a long-running complaint for Democrats. So with Barack Obama, he had this amazing, people said, social media outreach campaign, these great lists, raised a lot of money, and then really left the states out in the cold. At least we've heard that from some in the state Democratic parties around the country. Is this a problem for Democrats in general, looking too much at the top of the ticket, leaving everybody else out in the cold?
Well, I mean, if we think about fundraising as a competition, because it is, I mean, there's a finite number of dollars out there. And I think that from the perspective of the National Party, they're running the national presidential campaign, let's say, they're running to get their person elected. Now, there's a lot of strategy involved. And let's say, for example, the Clinton campaign had paid more attention to some of the races going on in the state of Wisconsin, and perhaps had put more money into supporting Democratic candidates within the state of Wisconsin, that might have helped Hillary Clinton. But they chose to not do that. And so Wisconsin was one of the states that really didn't see a whole lot of return on investment for the money that was getting sent back up to the party.
Talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at these revelations from Donna Brazile, former interim chair of the DNC, Democratic National Committee, about the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC. Susan, this is history, but it's happening in the present on the eve of elections for governor in places like Virginia, hotly contested campaigns. What does this do to the Democratic Party over the next week?
Well, I think that I don't know that it'll have a big effect on the Virginia race because they've got their own issues that they're dealing with. It might make, you know, it potentially it could have some people who were Sanders supporters feel as if they're not going to, you know, want to go out and vote. But I don't know that it'll have immediate impact, but I think longer term it could.
Senator Elizabeth Warren talked to CNN's Jake Tapper about these allegations in the DNC. She says she's encouraged the new chair, Tom Perez, to seek reform in the party. Here's a little bit of that conversation.
You have got to put together a Democratic Party in which everybody can have confidence that the party is working for Democrats rather than Democrats are working for the party. And he's being tested now. This is a test for Tom Perez. And either he's going to succeed by bringing Bernie Sanders and Bernie Sanders representatives into this process, and they're going to say it's fair, it works, we all believe it, or he's going to fail. And I very much hope he succeeds. I hope for Democrats everywhere. I hope for Bernie and for all of Bernie's supporters that he's going to succeed.
Very quickly, Senator, do you agree with the notion that it was rigged?
Yes.
Did this notion, Susan, that the Democratic Party was behaving undemocratically during the primary, do you think it put off some potential voters?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think once we got to the point of the general election campaign, I think there were a fair number of Bernie Sanders supporters who chose to not participate or who chose to vote for, let's say, Jill Stein in the general election because they felt that the process had not been fair to their candidates.
We definitely heard anecdotally callers on this show saying they had voted for Bernie Sanders in the Wisconsin primary because of the party's treatment of him. They're going to vote for no one, or as you say, Jill Stein, or even in a couple cases, Donald Trump. Just anecdotes there, but this was a problem in a very close election in close states like Wisconsin.
Right, and if you're talking about margins that are in the, you know, low tens of thousands, that those can make a difference. Or if you stay home, right? I mean, the same thing.
We're talking to Susan Johnson about allegations from former DNC Chair Donna Brazile about the Clinton campaign and its role in the Democratic nomination process last year. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts, your reactions to these claims from Donna Brazile? Does it change your perception of the 2016 election or reinforce it? What does it mean for the Democratic Party? Is there a way for the Democrats to fix this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about revelations from former Democratic National Committee Interim Chair Donna Brazile, alleging that the Clinton campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign, was able to sway the nomination process in Clinton's favor because of its control over campaign donations. Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that news? Were you a Bernie Sanders primary voter? How did you feel about the way things went? Did you vote ultimately for Hillary Clinton or someone else? Were you affected by the perceived treatment of Bernie Sanders by Democrats? What would you want to see from Democrats moving forward? How should primaries work, Republican or Democrat? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers now. Jack is with us in Eau Claire. Jack, hi.
I think we seriously underestimate the number of people that did not show up for the Democrats. You know, Bernie Sanders, everybody knew, I think, that was paying attention that he wasn't going to get the nomination. He was a Democrat temporarily just to get the nomination. It didn't go his way. No one thought it would. And when it didn't, those people, I think a lot of them just stayed home. I think you've mentioned already a few went a different direction, but a lot of them just, you know, bailed out of the whole process at that point. And therefore, I think Trump had a good advantage here in Wisconsin.
Jack, thanks for the call. And Susan, can polling get at that sort of thing? Did polling get at that sort of thing? Sanders supporters who ended up moving away from Hillary Clinton?
You know, it's sometimes difficult. Well, it's generally difficult to poll people who didn't vote. So there's that. And the other thing is certainly in polling, people can be asked, you know, who did you support in the primary process? And then who are you going to vote for? And I honestly haven't seen any I'm sure that it's been done, but I haven't really seen anything that I can speak to that would, give you definitive numbers. But, I mean, we said anecdotally that, this was occurring, and I think that the caller's right that it probably was more than we think.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Peter in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I voted for Jill Stein, and I don't really feel bad about it. I feel like Hillary Clinton really made no effort to progressives to give us any reason to vote for her. If you look at her primary critique of Trump, it wasn't that he was like a Republican who was going to cut Social Security and cut Medicaid and lower taxes on the rich. Her primary critique of him was that he used bad language and, oh, what would our children think? If you look at what happened at the DNC, she didn't. She brought on a bunch of right-wing, the Leon Panetta, the CIA, basically all the people from the military-industrial complex to endorse her, a bunch of Republicans. So she really made zero effort to win progressive votes.
Peter, thanks for that call. And Susan, that split, if we want to call it establishment Democrat or centrist Democrat versus the progressive wing, that's still alive and well, that split in the Democratic Party, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the caller made two points. I mean, the first point was that she didn't do much to try to bring in those Sanders supporters, and then also her campaign didn't have much of a message. And so I think those are two important points.
And at this point in time, I mean, we've got a lot of attention on the Republican side of things and Donald Trump versus the establishment of his own party, and Democrats, in theory, would be happy to try to seize on that. Does this make it harder for them to do that, this split in their own party?
That's a good question. I think if we go back historically, and I won't bore your listeners with the whole history of all of this, but this is not new. I mean, this has been ongoing, and I mean, we can just think back to 1968 and that convention where you had the liberal and the more establishment wing of the Democratic Party battling it out. And if you look at the history of the Democratic Party, let's say even post-1968, this has been a common problem or a common issue with the party. And I think that it's been heightened, I would say, now, and there's more attention being placed on it maybe than there had been perhaps, because Bernie Sanders has not gone away and he keeps talking about it, and new allegations or issues keep coming up, and Hillary Clinton, remains in the public eye as well. And I think what we've seen from our polarized political environment is just because you might be having problems, it doesn't mean that would preclude you from going after the other party for what you perceive as their problems.
What's the Will Rogers quote? Something like, I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat.
Right.
I mean, is there some chronic thing in the Democratic Party that it's hard to manage, hard to wrangle people all in the same direction?
Well, I mean, what we see with the Democratic Party is that it's a very diverse party in terms of the different groups that it pulls from. And we've had historically through different points in time, like I said, different groups coming up, and when the more liberal wing of the party was able to wrest some control of the party after 68, we saw reforms to the party that made the party more open, let's say, and then we saw the establishment wing kind of come back. And so this has been ongoing, like I said, for several decades with the Democratic Party, and I don't see it going away, as we can see from what's going on right now.
Talking to Susan Johnson, political scientist at UW-Whitewater, looking at the Hillary Clinton campaign, the DNC, and new revelations from Donna Brazile about influence of the Hillary Clinton campaign on the Democratic Party during the primaries. Back to your calls now. Ruth is on the line in Milton. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I'm a longtime member of the Democratic Party, live here in Milton, Wisconsin, and Hillary Clinton has been a loyal, longtime member of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders never did join the Democratic Party nor really contribute anything to the Democratic Party. He's a fine person in our national government, but he expected too much from we Democrats, and I'm angry about Donna Brazile bringing this out now. We need to be united, even though there are people like me who are moderates and appreciate Hillary's work with women and children, and I think she's been really given a really rough time, and that means I've been given a rough time. I'm pretty darn mad.
Ruth, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, we've been talking about anger from the more progressive pro-Bernie Sanders wing in the Democratic Party. There's anger from people like Ruth, too.
Well, absolutely. And I think that when people who are Hillary Clinton supporters hear about processes being rigged and things like that, then, I mean, they go back and they look at the circumstances and they would argue that it wasn't rigged. And I think Ruth's point that Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat and very recently was approached about becoming a Democrat and chose not to. I mean, the nomination process, for better or worse, is a process within the party. And so it's the party selecting who it wants to represent it moving forward. And so I think it's a valid point that when you're talking about the party apparatus, let's say, not necessarily support or maybe supporting one candidate more than another or something, he was not and he remains not a Democrat.
Ruth, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rolf in Wausau. Rolf, hi.
Yes, hello. My question is, I would like someone to perhaps maybe the Justice Department look into the diversion of funds, the allegations made by the author of the diversion of campaign finance funds back to Hillary. I would think that might be somewhere along the lines of violation of campaign finance laws.
Rolf, thanks for the call. Susan, is there any indication that this was not just maybe bad for Democrats, but potentially illegal?
From everything I read, and I'm not a legal expert when it comes to campaign finance, but from what everything I've read, people are raising ethical questions, but not necessarily legal ones. But I'll tell you, I'm guessing that right now people are looking very closely at what all happened back when during the campaign to see if perhaps there are any legal concerns.
Rolf, thanks a lot for that call. And Susan, something I come back to looking back at that campaign, you had one party, the Republicans, who ended up nominating really a non-Republican, a party outsider, and one party that went with the party insider over the insurgent outsider campaign. And who ended up winning?
Right. Well, the outsider.
Yeah. So is there a lesson here for future politics? When do we know if 2016 was an outlier, an anomaly itself versus a new normal?
Well, I mean, I guess we know after several election cycles. So let's look at what happens in the midterm and then 2020 and beyond. But I don't know that we can make any judgments based on one election.
Do you see Democrats after 2016 and after, new revelations and new efforts to rip off Band-Aids here, do you see them coming together in time for a solid 2018 campaign?
Well, in terms of 2018, I think that they're focusing on key races in the House and Senate. I think moving forward to 2020, someone will be nominated and most of the party will support that person because they want to see a Democrat in the White House.
All right, we'll leave it there. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Have a good weekend.
We've been talking to Susan Johnson. She's an associate professor of political science and the director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater. She joined us today to talk about former DNC chair Donna Brazile's claims that the Hillary Clinton campaign, in effect, rigged the nominating process in their favor during the primary election campaign at the expense of then-candidate Senator Bernie Sanders. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this story. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. What do you see as the prospects for the Democratic Party coming together, for the Republican Party, for that matter? What are your hopes and fears for the 2018 midterm elections? Share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page.